This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk about electric airplanes with George Bai, the founder, CEO, and chairman of Bai Aerospace. In the news, AeroShark aircraft skin technology, the 2021 Collier Trophy finalists, a hydrogen fuel-powered aircraft engine, more lasers pointing at airplanes, and the F-35C crash video leakers are charged. We also have an Israeli news desk, a new listener poll, and more. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 693 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian from the American Helicopter Museum.
Hello, everyone. Looking forward to a great conversation tonight. Electrics is something Max and I talk about on the other show a lot today. Looking forward to discussing it here.
Yes, we are going to discuss it here. And to help us with that, we have Rob Mark. He's a contributing editor to Business and Commercial Aviation, part of the Aviation Week group, and he's publisher at Jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening. And for this special occasion, I made sure to put fresh batteries in my mouse so that there'll be no failures along the way.
Have you put the dog away so that there'll be no interruptions?
The dog is also not coming up here. He will be doing whatever he does when I'm not there, which is probably sleeping.
No doubt. All right. Well, let's introduce our guest. We have an exciting guest this episode, George Bai. He's the founder, CEO, and chairman of Bai Aerospace, founded in 2007. George has over two decades of experience as an aerospace entrepreneur, engineer, and executive. He's definitely a well-known conceptual design engineer. He's consulted with major OEMs on their advanced development programs. George was part of the conceptual design leadership team on the Boeing TX program, now known as the T-7A Red Hawk, U.S. Air Force Advanced Jet Trainer. He provides expert reviews for Lockheed Martin. George has developed a number of aircraft designs, including an all-electric E-Flyer family, and he previously designed several solar electric aircraft. Of course, George is a pilot, an ATP-rated pilot with over 4,000 hours. He was an Air Force instructor pilot in the supersonic T-38, the C-117B instructor aircraft commander, and he is a Desert Storm veteran. George, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Boy, it sure is a pleasure to see everybody and looking forward to our conversation tonight.
It's going to be very fascinating. It was almost 4 years ago since George was last on the podcast. We have a lot of catching up to do. There's been some interesting developments, of course, in the electric airplane segment of this industry. But first, we've got some aviation news from the past week. Is everybody ready?
You bet. In the Midwest.
From the first state.
Our first story comes from Aviation Business News. This is Swiss adopts AeroShark aircraft skin technology. Lufthansa Technik and BASF co-developed this aircraft skin technology that they call AeroShark. And it's meant to reduce drag and improve fuel consumption and therefore leading to lower emissions. This AeroShark film contains riblets, they call them, that kind of imitate the flow characteristics of shark skin. Boy, you know, we're always looking for greater efficiency in aircraft, and this is one that I really wasn't expecting.
No, this came out of nowhere. I mean, I realize that I'm not an engineer, so if I were, I would probably be watching this closely. But at first, when I read this, I thought, what, they're going to stick something to the outside of the airframe and it's going to make airflow better. better airflow, improved efficiency. But boy, it sure sounds like that's what they've done. But I still wonder. Well, there are a couple of questions, but I'm not an engineer. Of course, we have one on the show. Maybe we can ask him when we get a chance.
George, are you familiar with this concept?
Yeah, so you have airflow over an airplane, and yes, there's been some studies about what we call a shark skin kind of approach to the very, very close layer of air, the boundary layer of air from the skin to the flow. And as you might imagine, as you get very, very close to the skin of the airplane, there's an opportunity, at least some think, if the airflow can be better organized, that there might be an opportunity to reduce drag. This approach is one suggestion for that. There's been other kinds of approaches over the years, going back to the 1950s and years ago. But the hope is that drag can be reduced, that skin friction drag and that boundary layer of air between the actual skin of the airplane and the flow of the air over the surface.
This AeroShark technology has been applied to the Boeing 777 freighters of Lufthansa Cargo. I think that was the first application. And Swiss International Airlines is planning to equip its 12 777-300ERs with this AeroShark technology beginning in the middle of this year. Now, they say the fuel savings is thought to be around 1%. Which sounds kind of small, especially in light of some other advances, for example, with engine technology that have given double-digit fuel burn improvements. But prior to that, you know, airlines were more than happy to get a 1% here, a 1% there, because after a few years, it starts to add up. And with fuel costs what they are, 1% is not insignificant. So it's a small improvement, but I got really curious about this. So I kind of did some research, and I found something called the Reef Quest Center for Shark Research. And I wanted to see if I could find out this really what was going on with these sharks in this kind of skin surface. And a piece in here explains that, you know, these skin surface features for aerodynamic effect is really nothing new. Probably the most common example of that might be the dimples on a golf ball, which are different sizes in different areas of the golf ball. Those dimples have a positive effect on the airflow or the aerodynamics of the golf ball. It also says that many U.S. military aircraft and even ships utilize certain V-shaped grooves that are placed along the fuselage or the hull to achieve similar kind of effect. So we'll put a link to this this piece in the show notes. So if you really want to get in deep about how sharks can swim faster with these riblets on their skin, you can really dive into that. All right, another thing that happens this time of year is the Collier Trophy finalists are announced. This is the 2021 Collier finalists. We see that there are four finalists for the trophy this time around. The DARPA, Air Force, Raytheon Missiles and Defense, and Northrop Grumman hypersonic air-breathing weapon concept. Second one is the Dynetics and DARPA X-61 Gremlins air vehicle. Dave and I talk about that on UAV Digest. Third is the NASA JPL Ingenuity Mars Helicopter Team. And fourth is the Space Logistics and Intelsat Mission Extension Vehicle 2 Team. So those are the four finalists who are competing. I don't know, do you guys have any favorites or any predictions?
I guess my first observation is not a single one of these has a person in them.
You are right. There's no pilots in any of these, are there?
Not one of these. Now, I personally, given the fact that the museum's choice for last year's award for 2021 was Ginny, I'm kind of personally connected to Ingenuity, but all four of these projects, I just thought it was kind of interesting that not a single one involved man flight. A little more detail, Hawk, or the HAWC, is a hypersonic test vehicle, which is unmanned. The Gremlins, if you don't know about the Gremlin program, is the Gremlin is an air recoverable, air deployed drone that drops out the back of a C-130 and then flies back to the C-130 and is hoisted back into the aircraft. I think anyone who listens to the show knows what Ginny is, or Ingenuity, the first helicopter to fly on Mars. And the other item is space resupply.
The mission extension vehicle is something that I hadn't been familiar with. And we'll have links to all of these projects in the show notes. But in looking at this mission extension vehicle, it's a satellite life extension vehicle. And what it actually does is it can dock to a satellite whose fuel supply is running out. And they do this with geostationary satellites. And then it uses its own thrusters and fuel supply to extend the satellite's lifetime. I think that's a fascinating concept. This one might be my favorite because it's a way to address an issue with satellites that are becoming non-functional because they run out of fuel, and basically going up there and attaching something to them that brings fuel with it and provides the maneuvering and all to keep the satellite functioning properly. All four of these are interesting.
Yeah, but I think the hypersonic air-breathing weapon concept sounds really cool, even though right now I could not define what speed hypersonic is. Anybody know? Is that like more than Mach 4 or something? Or
more than Mach 5.
More than Mach 5. That was going to be my next guess. Okay.
Probably because
that's pretty.
The other three of us were holding up our hand with all five fingers extended.
I was looking at the page here with the information on it. I didn't even see the cheat sheet fingers. Right. But it's like hypersonic is, there we go.
Five times the speed of sound.
Those are launched from an aircraft too, or are those ground launched?
Hypersonic needs
air in the engine to get.
Right. So you have to get it up to speed before the hypersonic, the ramjet or the scramjet starts to function. So you can airdrop them from another aircraft, or I guess attach them to a missile or something.
Have you noticed that we should have George on more often because he's giving us the answers visually here with some handies, but
pilot always talks with his hands.
Yeah, that's true. So, but I don't know. We'll see. Let's see. The cutoff is
The committee meets March 31st, 2022. Then they'll announce the winner after that. And as I mentioned, we'll have all four of these as well as links to the programs in the show notes. And we thought we'd do another listener poll this time. And what we'll ask is just simply which of these four finalists would you like to see win the Collier Trophy? And as we always do when we have a poll, you can find that at airplanegeeks.com/poll693, because this is episode 693. That'll be the poll for this episode. So we'll see what people think are their favorites amongst these four. I think all four of them are great candidates.
And people don't need to send in their white paper of 10 pages or less to explain why they made the choice they did.
No, it's not a homework assignment.
Okay, good. I like that. Yeah, I like it.
One multiple choice question. All right. We also have an item, Airbus and CFM to equip A380 with hydrogen-powered engine. Airbus and CFM internationally, might have seen this in the news, are planning on using an Airbus A380 for a hydrogen-powered flight demonstration. They're going to mount this engine on the or towards the rear of the fuselage, and then install some hydrogen tanks, four hydrogen tanks inside the rear cabin. You know, depending on which report you read, there's some kind of different perspectives as to this exactly when this is going to happen. In one article, Airbus will only say that the flight will occur around the middle of this decade. Another report says that the demonstrator will start flight tests at the end of 2026, which I guess is around the middle of the decade, to inform decisions around the 2035 hydrogen passenger aircraft configuration. So interesting, using an A380. It's a kind of a, well, it's a kind of a unique or maybe special A380 because it's serial number 001. Some people are saying, well, why are they putting this on an A380? That seems like kind of big overkill. But 001 is an instrument aircraft. I mean, it's configured for instrumentation, which, of course, is what they want. It's probably, and this is just my opinion, it's probably just laying around. I mean, they probably don't have any other use for serial number 001. It allows them to mount this engine, this test engine, up in the back of the fuselage because they want to measure the output of the engine, the water and so forth. They want to assess the contrail coming out of this thing. And so that way it's out of the airstream of the engines. Yeah, we can look forward to that. You know, George, there's just so many things going on these days with interesting propulsion systems and interesting kinds of aircraft. And of course, electric, which we'll be talking a lot about. The competition for our excitement and enthusiasm is pretty large these days.
I'm excited about the various kinds of energy storage. And of course, hydrogen is one of them that has been discussed for some time. And of course, it has taken our astronauts and cargo and satellites aloft for decades and decades. So it's new in some ways, and yet a technology that we know really well for years and years and years. Not easy to put on an airplane for all the reasons that, you know, those of us who have an aerospace, emphasis space, rocketry background, hydrogen is hard to work with in many, many ways. So this will be a great effort and lots of focus on the results they find.
I'm assuming that these four hydrogen tanks for this test are liquid hydrogen and not compressed hydrogen, but I don't know that for sure.
I believe they might be gaseous hydrogen.
Okay.
Now, check me on that, but I believe the approach is with gaseous hydrogen. And one of the advantages of the Airbus is its large volume. It can accept those large tanks. Of course, volume is one of the concerns with hydrogen in the gaseous form, but the cryogenic format is very challenging as well. You know, the cold temperatures all by itself is just really a challenge to work with. But I believe it's gaseous. Check me on that. I don't know for sure.
All right, we'll try to find out. That, of course, is the one of the issues with hydrogen fuel. Obviously, the containment vessel for liquid hydrogen is much more challenging, much more robust than be the case for this compressed or gaseous hydrogen. But you can store a lot more hydrogen in this in a smaller space if it's liquid, obviously, than if it's a gas.
Is anybody else getting the vibe about a very large vehicle filled with hydrogen gas and Lakehurst coming to mind?
Makes you a little nervous, David.
Kinda, yeah. Maybe a humanity thing.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yes, dear. Okay.
You're not entitled to have all the bad jokes, Rob.
No, I know. I you're right. I have to make room for some other ones. But what I was trying to figure out, too, is that, George, you said that it's difficult to work with. I'm not a chemist. I'm not a propulsion person. What makes it difficult to work with?
So hydrogen is very energetic. It's a single atom. The atomic structure, of course, is very small, very tiny, and so it likes to leak. And when it mixes with other things, that becomes a very volatile or potentially volatile mix. And so there's safety concerns around hydrogen itself atomically. And then, of course, the transfer and the linkage, the valves and such that have to manage this flow of hydrogen, which eventually becomes gaseous. And you have either the temperature conversion or you have the flow of the hydrogen becomes a real challenge to manage safely. Of course, rockets, before they're flown, are loaded with the cryogenic fuel just before flight for some of those reasons. Same thing with the oxygen up above in the oxygen tanks. So we know how to kind of manage it from a rocketry perspective. An airplane, of course, it's quite a different mission. And the longevity, the consistent ability to load and unload the fuel, to manage it, to burn it, or to otherwise contain it, requires certification and safety on an immense level, again, with the intention that we're carrying commercial passengers. So there's a lot there. It turns out it's pretty hard to do.
So the challenge is not just to see if the fuel will be as efficient as they hope and, eliminate contrails. And then how do we work with it? How do we produce it and transport it to a place where it can be safely loaded on an airplane? Is that not, as an engineer, do you not wonder? They may get to the end point and say, wow, it's absolutely is great, but we don't have a clue how to work with it, safely, and it's just not worth all that work.
Imagine the new infrastructure required for a hydrogen-based fuel system at all of our various airports and such. Not only how is it transported and put into the various tanks for loading onto airplanes, how is that done? But then you get back even further in the supply chain. How is it produced and where does it come from? And
right.
How do we get it to the various tank farms at the airports? There's a tremendous linkage for how we do business in aviation. And these are not trivial. These are gigantic concerns. And, of course, the cost of fuel. We have a very noble cause. And Airbus is undertaking this research for a very important reason. But it's not an easy task ahead.
Yeah, lots of challenges. All right. We see in Aviation Week, maybe an increase perhaps in laser pointer incidents. Rob, what's this all about?
This is the dumbest story I can remember writing in ages, because this is just, people pointing green lasers at airplanes. And again, even for the people that aren't aware of the strength of their lasers, to say, let's see, what am I going to do with this thing? I know, I'll point it at an airplane. It's just unbelievable to me that there are people that would do that. Now, I would have thought that we'd be seeing laser pointer incidents on an interstate, perhaps, with somebody, sitting on the corner there having a couple of beers and going, hey, let's shoot some lasers at the trucks when they go by. But to my knowledge, that kind of thing does not occur. But in airplanes, it's happening. And the numbers have been astronomical, the increases, I should say. And this January, FAA reported that we're on track for another banner year of laser pointer incidents, because we're far ahead of what we did in the previous January. And it's really frightening, I guess, because we see incidents all over the place, but luckily nobody has been seriously hurt. However, it's like some serious gambling going on here. I mean, how long will it take before there is a serious injury that causes a pilot to lose control of the airplane? And of course, the biggest problem is tracking these people down. In the story, I mentioned a number of biz jet pilots that I talked to that said they had been targets. And of course, all they can do is report it to ATC, but it's the helicopter guys, the local constabulary, that are getting hit often. And luckily, they have the maneuverability to be able to, if they're not injured, to, you know, stop on a dime, turn it around, and call in the Marines to help them pin down this person. And often they are just people sitting in their backyard, sitting in a truck somewhere, just shooting it out the window, and they're still there when the cops come back. And so it's pretty easy to catch those guys. But airplanes, no, not quite so easy. I guess the biggest issue is that, you know, why are these happening now? Nobody's really sure, except the fact that you can buy a powerful green laser on Amazon for $30. And, you know, if you have Prime shipping, you get it shipped to you for free. I don't, to my knowledge, know if there are any, safety guidelines in the packet. I would hope that they say something like, you know, don't point this at somebody's eyes, or if you're playing with your animal, don't aim it at a dog's eyes or a cat's eyes. But again, it's this proliferation of cheap lasers that you can buy everywhere. And maybe the fact that during the pandemic, there were people with a little more time on their hands, although that's simply speculation. But trouble is, we've got to do something because, again, I just happen to think that you can't keep having these kinds of incidents, which they've been tracking for more than a decade, I believe, and not have the odds catch up with us. And you know what? Then if there is a fatal accident or even a major incident, then FAA and the government's going to go nuts. They're going to say, oh, my God, how could this happen? Why didn't we do something about this before? And who knows what kind of action they're going to take. So right now, this is an unfinished story.
It's a tough one. All of the news reports I've seen where someone has been identified doing this, caught doing this, it's like you said, Rob, it was a result of a law enforcement helicopter that could quickly go and identify where this was coming from. But yeah, for airliners, I don't recall anybody ever being caught doing that.
Nah, because reporting at ATC, I mean, approach control says, okay, 777 on downwind for 27 right at O'Hare got hit around the area. What are the cops going to do with that? They can't send out half a dozen squad cars hoping that maybe somebody shines the laser at them. And there's no other way to catch them.
It is an unfinished story. I don't know what the solution is. But I agree with you, Rob. It's a dangerous situation. Very dangerous. Another dangerous situation that was recorded on video was of course, the F-35C crash on the, what carrier was that, David?
The Vincent.
The Carl Vinson.
Carl Vinson.
Thank you, Rob.
So we've seen some videos, some leaked videos. They were always described as leaked videos, at least the ones that I saw. And I was always wondering what was going to happen to the whoever it was that leaked the video. Well, now we see that there are some consequences for that. David, have you been keeping up on this story?
Somewhat. This information has come out because, I mean, it was very newsworthy. It was the first F-35C that crashed at sea. Was a ramp strike. There was severe injuries to sailors aboard the aircraft carrier. The pilot did eject out safely, but releasing the footage to the general media of, and the footage they were using was the footage you use to review pilots for approach and landing. Every landing aboard an aircraft carrier is videotaped, so the pilot can see how they did on the landing, and it's scored. So there's always this footage, and this footage usually gets sent out eventually after the investigation by the Department of Defense. In this case, seven sailors had leaked the information, which technically is classified, out to the general public. So if you're going to leak classified information, there are going to be consequences. it's understandable that the Navy's causing a penalty for it. Although we were all wanting that information, there's the right way and the wrong way to get it out to the public. And this clearly was one of those wrong ways.
So five of them have been charged. An ensign and four chief petty officers have been charged with violations of Article 92 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is failure to obey a lawful order. The Navy's not releasing the names of these sailors, but I think they're in some hot water, so to speak.
They're going to be court-martialed. At minimum, they probably will get dishonorable discharges. More to the point, some of them might actually even get charged if their court-martials could go to in-time imprisonment at a federal prison. So, I mean, leaking classified information or going against orders to do so, I'm sure that there were Vincent was getting requests from the media, we want this footage, but it needs to come from the top down and not from the bottom up. So unfortunately, these sailors are going to be in for a long haul over the next couple of years.
Won't be fun.
Sure. And for people that have never been in the military, there is nothing worse, than being let go from the military. I mean, I remember this in basic training in the Air Force that they said, oh, my God, you do not want a dishonorable discharge because that will screw up the rest of your life forever. And it's certainly going to have a pronounced effect on these seamen.
Keep in mind the average age on an aircraft carrier is 20. I mean, these probably are young kids with a long life ahead of them that at the time thought they were doing the right thing, but there will be consequences. I mean, anyone who's ever applied for a job knows that they ask you, did you ever serve in the military? And then the following question is, what was your discharge status?
Mm-hmm.
Too bad there's not an equivalent for people who shine lasers at airplanes, but at least these five folks are going to regret it. They don't already.
Yeah, I just thought of something. I wonder if they could tack a GPS onto the laser pointers somehow. You know, these GPSs can become very tiny these days on UAVs.
So you could put an ADS-B transmitter on laser pointers? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah. I'm going to suggest that to the big guys, whoever they are that track that sort of thing.
How about we just stop selling laser pointers to the general public?
Well, you know, seriously, that was a good point. And the editor and I had a moment about that. And I said, what good are these? Well, you know, you use a laser pointer on a PowerPoint presentation when you're presenting it, but not a 1200 milliwatt one that you can see 4 miles away. I mean, I don't know. Maybe somebody else knows the answer to this because I don't understand their purpose. I really don't.
I'm hesitating because I'm really reluctant to make the following statement, but there's kind of an analogy here with guns, you know? Some people say, what good are they? Or, you know, do you need them? Or do you need this one or that kind or one that looks like, you know, an assault rifle, you know, all that stuff. So, yeah, it's tough to legislate objects. You'd rather legislate behavior with those objects, but it doesn't always work.
But common sense, you can't legislate, so I don't know what to do about that. Yeah.
So, all right, let's move on to one. This is, this might be pretty stale by the time you all listen to this, but as a result of the activity, the situation in Ukraine, we see airspace being closed kind of worldwide. I mean, that's a big impact. The EU is closing airspace to Russian aircraft. Russia is closing airspace to the EU and a number of other countries. And this is going to be very disruptive to the routes that airlines fly and others as well.
Oh, absolutely. Not to mention, of course, the fact that I think until this really came to be in terms of the Russians invading Ukraine, most Americans had no idea how large a country the Ukraine is, and that the population was 40 million people. And most of all, I mean, you know, the Ukrainians are the underdogs here. And even though they're outgunned and outmanned, everyone is still rooting for them to be able to pull this off. But for one thing, they don't want anything to do with Russian airplanes. Nobody does right now. And I think even when this is over, I think it's going to be a while before they just say, hey, Aeroflot, you're welcome to pop into Heathrow or Paris or Frankfurt or whatever. I think it's going to change an awful lot of people's minds.
The world may be forever changing. And apparently the world is going to have to get along without the AN-225. Is that the big one?
225.
Yeah, AN-225 that reportedly.
Otherwise known as the Dream. From a military standpoint, the first strikes out of Kiev, they're just starting to release satellite image of the airport where the Mir is stored, and the hangar's pretty much level to the ground where it was being serviced. And clearly the airport, it was targeted by the Russians. Interestingly enough, the Russians haven't achieved any sort of air dominance over the Ukraine. The Ukrainian Air Force is doing a job on the Russians. I don't think they were expecting. And this also goes for the ground. As we speak on the 1st of March, clearly the Ukrainians are holding their own. From a military standpoint, the big rumor, propaganda, confirmation still is about the ghost of Kiev. It is a Ukrainian MiG-29 pilot who over the previous weekend was said to have shot down six Russian aircraft, making him an ace plus one. On Monday, it was released by the Ukrainian Air Force that this pilot does exist and now is claiming he's a double ace. There have been 10 Russian aircraft shot down by this MiG-29. Most of the Ukrainian Air Force is based on Russian aircraft. So it's one of those kind of fratricide kind of engagements where you've got Su-27s fighting Su-27s and MiG-29s versus MiG-29s. And while the Ukrainian Air Force, of course, is substantially smaller, they seem to be better trained and holding their own. Now, the Ukrainians and President Zelensky is asking for a no-fly zone over the country. I don't think that deconfliction will happen, but there is a chance of other aircraft going into and magically appearing part of the Ukrainian Air Force over the next couple of weeks or months in weapon supplies into the western side of Ukraine and probably deploying towards the more populated eastern side. But there's a lot of airspace that countries use over Russia, which is predominantly over Asia, but most Indian flights fly from India to the United States or North America, fly directly over Russia, part of their Great Circle route. Just now on Twitter, there was it looked like an Aeroflot flight that took off from Moscow and flew around Ukraine and then looked like it was heading for Rome. And it has turned around and is flying back to Russian airspace.
And it's definitely a fluid situation. As I said, by the time people listen to this, it could be a completely different situation. Again, we're speaking with George Bai, the man behind Bai Aerospace. George, again, thanks for coming on the show. As I mentioned before at the opening, it's been 4 years since you were on the show, and there have been a lot of activities in the electric aircraft space, a lot of companies getting involved of a variety of different sizes. When you look back over the recent few years. What do you observe are some of the trends, some of the big changes you see that have happened?
So, Max, I think what we've seen over the last 4 years is a great deal of new interest from parties, large and small, from startups to major OEMs, major aerospace companies, to include Boeing and Airbus and in the vertical takeoff and landing area at least, if not other areas. But oftentimes when I give a talk or a speech, you know, 4 years ago it was, George, how can you possibly imagine an electric aviation future? Doesn't this seem too far away and too futuristic? And now, of course, people are like, oh my gosh, this is clearly this is obvious. You know, how come it's not happening yet? So, and that gives us the opportunity to differentiate a little bit because there's so much announced in the media that I'd almost call it clutter. So many people are saying, well, we view this, we project that, we have a prototype that's getting an FAA airworthiness certificate. And of course, immediately the media jumps, well, they have an FAA, you know, they're certified. And, you know, people misunderstand. And it's, well, is it this kind of an electric or is it that kind? Is it going to be some kind of a new market around vertical takeoff and landing or is it conventional and classic? So I would have to say, in many ways, in the last 4 years, we've gone from non-obvious opportunities to change classic aviation with electric propulsion with a number of new ideas and new concepts that have explored not just battery-powered electric aviation, but other kinds of fuel, other kinds of configurations to include a great deal of attention around electric vertical takeoff and landing, if you will, call it an electric helicopter, but without the long, high aspect ratio, long propeller blades that we're used to with a helicopter, ducted fans or open rotors of some kind or another, which present other opportunities and other challenges. But the last 4 years has been fascinating, Max. I certainly wouldn't have predicted so much attention and so much money going into one sector absent the other. But the journey has certainly gone from questions around whether this is viable to almost an obvious, well, of course this is coming, and how will you achieve it?
And what about the regulatory landscape? Has that become more friendly for electric aircraft?
Again, so much confusion. The regulatory landscape is just, there's a scattering of misinformation, again, in the media. And even for those of us in the industry, you're led to believe that some aspects are much farther along than others. Back in April of 2018, just a few months after the Federal Aviation Administration revised Part 23, 14 CFR 23, with Amendment 64, allowing for the first time a conventional fixed-wing power plant to be electric on a normal category Level 1 airplane, by Aerospace applied, the first in the world to apply for a type certificate for a normal category fixed-wing aircraft. To date, that document and that regulation is the only one that allows for electric propulsion on an airplane. There are other efforts to kind of collect various parts and pieces of this regulation or that one, maybe an amendment or another view of this approach, and they call it, in the collection, powered lift, which is not a helicopter and not a fixed wing, but a collection of all kinds of other things. And again, that's kind of distracting. People don't really understand it. Lots of misinformation. But the fundamental roadmap of electric propulsion around the normal category Part 23 regulation is a fixed-wing airplane, a Cessna, Piper, Cirrus, or by Aerospace, with an electric power plant in the front, a certified under Part 33 power plant in the front, battery packs that have been TSO'd and tested under DO-160 and other equivalent kinds of ASTM regulations and criteria to meet all of the criteria, all of the safety necessary for a Part 23 normal category aircraft to be put into public use, meaning flight training, for hire, air taxi, cargo, normal category. And that's, again, I find myself spending more and more time trying to explain to people what the actual existing regulation is, what the administrator and the FAA team is actually working with, and all of these other projects that are kind of taking media time, and rightly so, because these projects are interesting, but there's a big, big gap between what's known and the kind of distractions and misunderstandings.
On the battery technology front, we oftentimes talk about energy density, and have we seen advances in energy density of the batteries or new battery technologies or other ways to address that issue?
Oh, my goodness. Fascinating topic. And as some of you know, we go back many, many years with different prototypes of electric aircraft. Our first one was the conversion of a Cessna 172. And the battery energy density was going from 100 watt-hours per kilogram to 160.
That's a big jump.
It was substantial at the time. And the electric propulsion system was a combination of two electric motors that were otherwise used for ground transportation vehicles, an electric vehicle on the ground, you know, something like a golf cart or an electric boat. So very, very early in the thought process of what an electric airplane might be able to do and how it might fly and such, we went from 160 watt-hours per kilogram to 200, 220, 240, 260, and now we're looking at over 300 watt-hours per kilogram, and this is over the last 8 to 10 years. First and second generation lithium-ion technology and an 18650 kind of AA battery size and going to pouch cells, much higher density, much greater packing efficiency. So energy density has doubled, almost tripled in 10 years. Packing efficiency, generation 1 and 2 technology going to generation now 4 and 5 technology, with all of the safety, all of the features that you want to have and are so necessary to have on a normal category airplane for all of the uses that we would want to imagine, carrying people, training new pilots, and moving cargo.
Is there a...
Go
ahead, Rob.
I was going to say, I just think this is amazing that, George, I heard you speak at NBAA, oh gosh, maybe 2018, I think, or 2019. And at the time, you made the point of saying, but the battery technology is going to have to improve, kind of a, yeah, it's got to evolve. And I said, oh yeah, but you know, I'm sure it will, but wow, this is so cool. It really is. And to think of all the problems that it eliminates, we're dealing right now with still trying to get the lead out of 100 low lead in a way that we can still make a Bonanza or a Cirrus operate the way it should. And we haven't, that challenge has not been met as of yet. All the other, the emissions issue that just simply goes away. Now, of course, one thing I was going to ask you is the critics will say, oh, no, that's not really true because you have to burn some dinosaurs in order to make the electricity to charge those dang things. So it's not really going away. What's your response to that?
I love that question. And of course, it's true. In some areas of the country, in some areas of the world, but at a much larger scale, macro scale, where the efficiencies of converting carbon fuel into electricity are much, much better than on a small scale with a Lycoming or Rotax or Continental. And the key thing here is, of course, we're agnostic, and we hope it's hydroelectric, we hope it's wind or solar, and these kinds of things are coming along. But the key thing for us, my legacy, our legacy at BioAerospace, what we're trying to do is make a better future at the operating level with an airplane that has features that are just remarkable, taking us into the next generation of what we'd expect for aerodynamics and structure, for clean, aero-efficient operation. But the addition of the electric is without compromise in terms of the mission-specific outcome, the eFlyer 2 designed for pilot training, and having the right amount of energy in storage with sufficient FAA reserves for a normal category airplane whose mission is to bring in the next generation of pilots. We're appealing to young people today. Come explore this great thing that we all love right here. I mean, we know it. We've embraced it. It's our life. But I'm proud to kind of pass the baton on to the next generation, and I want to create an airplane that's attractive to them, not just environmentally and climate, and that's important, but from an operating cost perspective, from an efficiency, from a, even call it a cool factor. It's sleek. It's pretty. I want to kind of express myself to the next generation proudly in passing the baton on to them.
Well, as you develop, I know the eFlyer is not certified yet, but you're right now projecting perhaps the end of this year or early in 2024.
Oh yeah,
well, it really sounds like the future. Yeah. Gosh, is it sort of being developed in parallel that you've got to have the infrastructure at a flight school that might take half a dozen of these to not only work on them but to charge the airplanes in a way that they can get them back out on the line, and that's all got to be developed, isn't it?
You know, that's a great question, and the infrastructure has come up. Especially, perhaps more so previously than just recently, but we are very close to a crossover point with more chargers in the United States than gas stations. And, of course, in Scandinavia and parts of Europe, far, far more more charging stations than fuel stations, gas stations. The infrastructure, the prolific growth of charging stations now, much better understood than previously. And then the thought process of new market opportunities to the growing economies around the world, of course, much less expensive to have a charger than it is to develop a fuel tank farm for a new facility at an island resort or an underserved area of the country. It actually allows for greater utility rather than a logistic restriction from utility using avgas in parts of the world where aviation gasoline simply is not available.
On the charging infrastructure, George, do you look towards basically plugging the charger into the plane, or battery packs that you swap out so that you can turn the plane around much more quickly?
Yeah, Max, it's a charging system, a plug-in, just like an electric vehicle, Tesla or equivalent ground automobile replacement plug-in. Just as I have a Tesla Model 3, and it's very, very intuitive and very, very easy to plug it in and recharge it. That's our approach.
I see that Max Trescott is, in fact, joining us right now.
He's in a hotel room, I can tell.
Yeah.
Hi there.
Hi. So,
hey, Max.
Are we waiting on Max Flight? I don't see him here.
Max Flight is there. But you're on a hotel connection. Come on. You know, you've got to throw more logs on the fire out there. The squirrels aren't spinning quite fast enough. But one thing I was going to ask, George, is that you mentioned it's going to be basically plug the airplane in when it comes back from a flight. I was under the impression that you can't rapidly charge these kinds of vehicles too often, or it really cuts down on the battery life. Is that true?
Certainly, the plug-in recharging of the EVs has become much better managed, and battery life much greater. It's been extended much farther than people originally imagined. The software within the chargers helps that management process, the state of charge of the battery pack, all kinds of kind of little technical nuances. But the ability to plug in, recharge timely, 20, 25 minutes between flights, is no longer than a typical avgas turn time. The ops tempo is maintained, and off you go with your next student and instructor or a passenger on your way to a charter operation or cargo. The turn time is very, very typical, not going to be an issue in terms of keeping up your ops tempo.
And George, I had a question about certification. With the Part 23 rewrite, you know, to some extent, one might think that would make things a little bit easier. And yet electrics are kind of a new area for the FAA, which I would imagine might make it a little bit more challenging for them. How are you finding the Part 23 rewrite working out for you in certification? Are there kind of some pros and some negatives to it?
Yeah, the FAA Amendment 64 to Part 23 was really well intended and allowed for kind of this birth of a whole new propulsion system on fixed-wing conventional aircraft, normal category aircraft. But we hadn't yet imagined what the actual process might be, and the roadmap wasn't laid out, the regulatory roadmap wasn't laid out. So there's been some pioneering by Aerospace, together with our partners in the FAA, have had to pioneer the process for certifying an electric aircraft. It's not, here's your milestones, here's a roadmap laid out for you, but rather let's work through what the issues might be, how we address them, and demonstrate safety.
George, let's give you the opportunity to describe the eFlyer a little bit better.
So we have the first model and the most mature airplane is the eFlyer 2, a two-seat level one primary trainer. And that aircraft is meant for the flight training, pilot training industry. Our focus with that airplane is to attract new young people into the profession of flying. Of course, some won't progress on to airline flying. Some may be recreational pilots or commercial pilot, with a private and an instrument rating or whatever it might be. But the key issue to be addressed with the eFlyer 2 is pilot training and the very great demand for new pilots that we have. The fundamental condition of the current pilot training aircraft fleet, close to 50 years old on average, hard to imagine, but close to 50 years old. And of course, the very great expense, the flight operating expense of these aircraft, fuel, avgas fuel-based, all by itself, energy cost is high. The cost of electricity by comparison is about one-tenth that of the avgas per flight hour of flying and operating. So in the collection, we can reduce cost, improve the product, a modern product to replace an aging fleet, and we believe attract new young people into an industry that we all know and love that is really, truly approaching desperation for new pilots.
What's the gross weight going to be a takeoff on an eFlyer 2, George?
It'll be with both pilot and instructor, or student pilot and instructor, it'll be 24 to 2,500 pounds, right in that range. So for those of us who've flown Piper Archer or Cessna 172, it'll be basically an identical aircraft in terms of its weight.
And this is a clean sheet of paper design, is that right?
Yeah, and that's right, Max. In fact, what's interesting is while it's the same weight of as a Cessna 172, the aero efficiency of the airplane is double that of a Cessna 172. 9.6, the lift-to-drag ratio, 9.6 for a Cessna 172, and over 17, in fact, over 18 for an L over D for the eFlyer 2. So literally twice the aerodynamic efficiency to perform the same mission, if you will. And so it's not just electric propulsion, but all of the other benefits for drag reduction, lift optimization, reduced cooling drag, and in combination, a really cool airplane.
George, this is kind of the reverse logic, but you're starting off with an aircraft that's completely electric and you're training students on a completely electric airplane. What's going to be their transition when they go to their next aircraft that will be on 100 low lead?
It's a good question.
Oh, I love that question. And thank you for asking, because again, as pilots, I think we all know, as we go from a Cessna 172 to a Cirrus SR-22, for example, or onto a more complex King Air or lighter medium twin, that we have transition training. We all do. We always do. We sit with an instructor, and we go through transition training. We get our logbook signed off for insurance purposes as well as for flying purposes. At the training syllabus progression, of course, we go through an entire process of learning from one aircraft to the next and to the next. That's going to be no different. But what I would point out, and this is perhaps obvious if I say it, but categorically, an electric motor is much more similar to a turbine aircraft, a turboprop turbine aircraft, than a piston engine is. Oh my gosh. 946 parts moving in violent opposition to each other, and that's a Lycoming Continental Rotax. One rotating part with torque and thrust, very much the same as one rotating part with torque and thrust on a turboprop, and then on, of course, to a turbofan in the future. So the training syllabus actually is more effective and more efficient because the transition training takes you from like kind of aircraft all the way through to the turbine-based turboprops and turbofans that the young commercial pilots and later ATP pilots will experience.
You mentioned the an interesting word there, torque. And I remember the few times that I've driven a Tesla, what really got me absolutely interested was when I put my foot on the gas and my nephew has one, and he said, "Oh, come on, I'll just punch it." And I went, "Okay." Whoa. I mean, and it threw me against the back of the seat because that thing has so much torque. And I'm just trying to imagine during a training, Max T, you might wonder about this too, on a go-around with a student, and the guy says, "Oh, that's right, that's where I jam the throttle forward and we climb." And, you know, I can almost imagine the airplane rolling over because it's got so much torque. But how are we going to cope with that? I know you've got the answer. I can see it in your hands, but so tell us.
So there's, of course, the torque is mass and velocity, and you have, of course, with a Lycoming or Continental, you have lag, right? You have the lag time between I'm telling it to do something, and then when it kind of kicks in, you have this large movement of a heavy propeller that's designed to take the vibration and the thrust through the torque, through the mechanical process of converting that engine, that thermal energy into torque and thrust. What's different about, of course, an electric motor, again, like a turbine, is you don't have that mass, and the propeller weight is much reduced because you don't have the vibration and torque features that you have from each of the cylinders firing as you do with a Lycoming and Continental. So, yes, there's an immediate access to thrust, but you don't have near the amount of P or torque that you might have. And again, the equivalency, of course, would be kind of reflecting as we would do with a turboprop as opposed to a Continental or a Lycoming.
George, where are we in the overall process? Test aircraft, production in the future. Where are we in that that whole project life cycle?
So, Max, we made that type certificate application back in April of 2018, and we went from preliminary design review into the critical design phase. And, of course, we've progressed with the various processes with the FAA, and we're now at the point where we're building the first production-conforming serial number one of the eFlyer 2 family of aircraft. So literally complete conformity aligned with the production-conformed airplane. And, of course, that will be used to show and demonstrate what we have on paper in an actual production aircraft. Serial number 2 and 3 will follow next year. This year, serial number 1. Next year, serial number 2 and 3. And those three aircraft will be used to demonstrate and complete that first type certificate for an electric airplane.
Are you finding component supply issues like everybody else in the world seems to be experiencing these days? Is that going to hold things up?
You know, I have people ask me, well, you know, how come the airplane doesn't cost less and why is it taking so long? And of course, all you have to do is look left and swing right, and you can look at the entire portfolio of supply chain, the other aircraft programs, conventional and not. And I don't even need to speak, but clearly there's been personnel issues. There's been you know, FAA access pandemic issues. There's been a whole technology that's emerged and is maturing and is needed in part and in whole, separately and integrated, that's required to create the world's first electric normal category airplane. So I'm not just certifying an airplane. We're doing the same thing with a battery pack. I'm not just certifying an airplane. I'm doing the same thing with a motor. And Safran is a great, great partner. They will have the first Part 33 certified electric motor in the world. They deserve a lot more coverage than what they're getting, by the way. Maybe invite them someday. But it's a big deal to have a Part 33 certified motor, not an experimental one, not on a developmental prototype, not an experiment, not we're trying this and we're trying that, we're doing a little demo flight today, but a certified motor in production for a normal category product, and the resulting benefits to student pilots and later, of course, to air charter and air taxi and cargo.
Do you have a location for a final assembly?
You know, we do, and that's going to be an exciting announcement coming up.
Oh.
But not quite yet.
Oh, okay.
Soon.
All right, good. So Max Trescott tells me that by the chat here that he can't hear me. So somebody ask Max if he's got another question before I start to wrap this up.
Do you have another question, Max, that you can—
Trescott.
Yeah, Max Trescott.
Yeah, we've got technical difficulties. I can't hear Max Flight here.
What, and that's so bad? I mean—
Oh, thanks, Rob.
Yeah, one of the benefits I think that doesn't get talked a lot about is maintenance cost. You know, I certainly thought immediately, hey, no oil changes. But talk a little bit about the reduced cost of maintenance on electric airplanes and how that impacts the overall cost of flying.
Well, I think those of us who are pilots and this audience is almost entirely airplane pilots or those that enjoy that with a friend or a partner or a spouse.
Yeah, we call them geeks.
There we go. So in flying, we all know maintaining the airplane to a high standard, a high quality of airworthiness is a part of the safety and part of the experience of flying. And by far the majority of that today is maintaining that Lycoming and that Continental engine in the front. Oh, my gosh. how many hours of maintainer's time, of maintenance time, is focused on doing something with that engine? And Max, to your point, 946 moving parts in a line combing, one moving part in an electric motor. I think that's all I need to say.
Yeah.
One moving part.
I just have one last question before we run. George, do you ever lose any sleep worrying that someday when these airplanes are really, you know, large in numbers at say control tower at airports, that someday the tower is going to call and say, that airplane that just left the ramp, tell him he's still plugged in. You know, I just wondered about that.
Rob, you're hilarious, man. You're hilarious.
Well, he thinks so anyway. Yeah.
You know, one thing I will point out just real quick in closing, I think we all know this, but electric vehicles are really quiet. I mean, really quiet. And until that propeller achieves a certain RPM, you can't hear it. So much like an EV, when it's rolling slowly through a parking lot, many of us can't hear the approaching electric car. And so while so many of us are happy to have noise complaints reduced because electric airplanes are becoming a possibility, at the same time, there's a safety aspect to that. We feel responsibility to make sure we have features on the airplane that alert people in proximity that it's in operation or it's about to be in operation. So we can keep maintainers and bystanders, et cetera, everybody safe.
George, I have one feature request, if you will. This is perfect because certainly if the airplane is quiet and you're sneaking up on people, that's a problem. I've always wanted a horn. Can you put a horn in it, please, so that we get people's attention?
Fantastic.
Flashing lights. You know. Yeah. Oh, Max, what you've missed over the last hour are the handies that George has been – he's been very effective in helping us craft this story. So for those of you that think we're really smart for asking all these great questions. No, George has been doing the hand maneuvers to kind of point us in the right direction.
Very expressive.
And he's been doing an amazing job at it.
So to kind of put a bow on this, why do you do this? What is it about starting an electric airplane company that gets your juices flowing? Why this?
Because he's not tooling around in a 141 anymore.
That's true. Or training young fighter pilots in the T-38, which I enjoyed both immensely. And, of course, what's going on in the world right now, it reminds me of my time in Desert Storm and other events around the world in the late 80s and early 90s. But I grew up in aviation, like many of us here today and many of us listening today. My passion for aviation began when I was just a youngster in grade school, and I flew in a Piper Cherokee with my family. My mother was the first pilot actually in my family, which was really cool. My dad followed, and we enjoyed aviation as a an experience I had growing up. I couldn't imagine not being a pilot. I wanted to be a jet fighter pilot, and of course in those days, go on to be an astronaut or a test pilot or something. I was fortunate to realize that dream. And I had to work really, really hard, like we all have here, to achieve it. I believe if there's a legacy for George Bai, for Bai Aerospace, I want to hand on into the future generations that same opportunity. But recognize that our legacy fleet is really long in tooth. We're nearly 50 years old. Our general aviation fleet, our Cessnas and Pipers, probably the ones I learned to fly on, are still flying today. And so there's a replacement of the legacy fleet. There's the great benefits of electric in terms of efficiency, operating costs. Oh, my gosh, one-fifth the operating cost. I mean, that's a disruptively wonderful benefit. And That will allow access to young pilots that otherwise couldn't even possibly imagine the economics of learning to fly, and welcome them to an industry, again, that we all love and the opportunity for employment. How wonderful is that? So, you know, and many other things. But Max, I have to say, it means a lot to me to be able to pass this along to future generations. I want to do my job as best as possible. And I know we all do here. We want to try to make the world a better place.
All right, George, thanks so much. The website is buyaerospace.com, and buy, of course, is B-Y-E, buyaerospace.com. Really appreciate it, George. Look forward to some great success with your endeavor here. I think your motivation behind this, as you've expressed it, is extremely laudable, and I think will contribute to the success of the company and to the concept in general. So I think you should be really proud of that. And I'm sure you'll be more proud when customers are taking delivery. And we look forward to that in, I guess, a couple of years' time. So thanks again, George.
Yeah, thank you all. It's been an honor. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for coming on the show, George.
All the best.
Thank you.
Thanks, George.
All right, what's up with the geeks? David, we are approaching the release, your exhibit at the American Helicopter Museum.
9 months of researching and producing. The wall boards and the exhibit boards go up tomorrow. Friday, we have our opening, which will feature Robert Connors, who is the curator of Rotary Wing Aviation at the National Air and Space Museum. And we will also have Frenchie, who was a HMX helicopter pilot, flew for President Bush 1 through Obama, as well as became commander of HMX 1, the Marine 1 helicopter squadron, and was also the commander that promoted the first woman helicopter pilot for the Marine 1 mission. So we'll have an interesting discussion. That'll be Friday night, March 4th. It is a members only, but the exhibit will run from March 5th to June 1st. The members only event, which we will probably be doing via Zoom, because one's in DC and one's in Chicago, one's in Hawaii. But we will probably put a recording of that up afterwards. But if you'd like to join live, it's a members only event. But I have a solution for you. The museum executive director, Paul, has agreed that we will give all Airplane Geeks listeners a 50% off their individual membership for a year. So what is normally $50 for their yearly membership, it will be $25. And that will, there'll be a link in our show notes, which would be airplanegeeks.com/693. And you click on that link, it will take you through an application and we'll send you out our cards. I know that currently, we have quite a couple of listeners already have signed up. It's definitely worthwhile. I am working on planning on having other live stream events with other book authors, etc. As the year goes on, we're working on formulating that. So believe me, you will get your $25 worth and you'll be supporting a good cause, a good museum. And Rotary Wing Aviation is not something we talk about a lot, but I think most pilots probably would find it interesting the more they got involved with it.
And I took advantage of that offer, David. I'm now an American Helicopter Museum member. And what I want to know is, do I get a cool hat?
We'll talk offline. I can get you a cool hat.
Okay.
David, tell us the title for your exhibit, because I don't think you said that.
The title of the exhibit is The Helicopter and the Presidency. I will be examining and talking people through basically 65 years of helicopter flight in the presidency. This year is the anniversary of Operation Alert. Operation Alert was a civil defense exercise in which President Eisenhower was, quote, evacuated, unquote, from the lawn of the White House to a secure location, which was Camp David. Ironically, I say evacuated because the whole process took about an hour and a half of him on the lawn walking around the helicopter in press photos. He was more on the ground around the helicopter than he was on the actual flight to Camp David. But President Eisenhower was the first president to fly in a helicopter. It was not Eisenhower's first helicopter flight, believe it or not. Ironically, the first vice president was his vice president, who became President Richard Nixon, flew in a Bell 47 or an H-13. He flew, believe it or not, Richard Nixon was the first vice president to fly in a helicopter, and he did it over the Korean demilitarized zone in a Bell 47. Oh. So we will talk about the various states, what the helicopter has been used for. We talk about Russian and U.S., or at that time Soviet-U.S. relations. President Eisenhower took Nikita Khrushchev on his first helicopter flight. Mr. Khrushchev was so excited about the helicopter, went back and ordered a bunch for himself later on. But the helicopter has been part of a day-to-day life up through the current president. Ironically, it was kind of interesting that the Secret Service originally didn't want the president to fly in a helicopter. The only president that has been effectively evacuated using a helicopter happened to be our former president, Donald J. Trump, when he was evacuated from the White House and flown to Walter Reed Medical Center because of his COVID diagnosis and the seriousness. So that's what we're talking about. Plus, I've got memorabilia from Richard Nixon's glassware, from Army One to patches. We talk about the VH-92, which is the replacement to the VH-3, which is what everyone thinks is Marine One. The majority of people know that Air Force One is a call sign, not an aircraft. We talk about that all the time. After the Bell 47s were used, it was decided that the Marine Corps and the Army would fly the president for two reasons. One, the Air Force was going to fly fixed wing. And second of all, the Marines were incorporated in flying the president because they didn't want it to look like Eisenhower was being partial to one service. So they split the service between Army and the Marines until Gerald Ford, where the Marines took over sole ownership of flying the president of the United States in rotary wing aviation. But believe it or not, there's been a Coast Guard too, where at one point the vice president of the United States, who actually is our current president, Joseph Biden, was flown over flood areas in Georgia and was flown aboard a Coast Guard MH-60. And that was the only time the Coast Guard call sign has ever been used in the history of aviation. So Coast Guard 2 went into effect. But I think people will take away some interesting aspects that they don't realize of something we take for granted, especially over the last three administrations, where almost every day we saw a president going somewhere with a helicopter in the background. It's really commonplace, and it's kind of extraordinary. It's gone from something that was a threat to the president to something that we don't even pay any regard to, taking off or landing on the White House lawn.
You don't hear any stories about somebody shining a laser at Marine One.
I'm sure, though, it's probably has happened.
Oh, that's right, because you wouldn't know. They just captured them and put them in a box or something, yeah. Right?
Moving on. Jeez. All right. This has something about Max Trescott just jumped out of a Vision jet. So you've been skydiving out of the Vision jet?
No. But first of all, we solved our technical difficulties. I can now hear you, which is great. And I'm coming to you from a secure location, which is in Southern California, where I've been working with a local client. Now, when I jump out of the Vision jet, it's about 1 foot from the bottom of the step to the tarmac. So we've been flying around all day. and just happened to get back to the hotel room here in time to kind of jump in the mid-show. So yeah, fun day. We zipped up to Sacramento, had lunch in Sacramento, and came back. Got a little bit of a late start, so we really only got two legs in today. Clear weather, just perfect, really just gorgeous flight all the way around. Great day for training. So that's what I'm up to for 3 days running around with this particular client. The reason is that when someone gets their type rating in the Vision Jet, they do it in a simulator. So then the FAA requires that they get 25 hours of SOE or supervised operating experience afterwards before they're then allowed to fly the jet by themselves. So I'm helping this newly typed person get his SOE hours, which is, what can I say? It's great fun. And I just want to mention that I just released episode 222 of the Aviation News Talk podcast, in which we had another George on as a guest. And of course, it was this case, it was George Brawley from GAMI. He's the inventor of G100UL. And so he answered a couple of good questions for us. First, you know, which piston engines will be able to use the G100UL, and also told us where the fuel is most likely to become available first. And he answered many, many, many other questions. So I would encourage folks to come on over and take a listen.
Great. And where is that again?
AviationNewsTalk.com, episode 222.
So in the title of the episode is, it's a gas?
Yeah, we didn't pass gas during the episode. No, so it wasn't about tankers.
You know what, Max? We need to get a one of those boom boom sound effects, because this whole joke thing is obviously getting out of hand. Now we've got David in on it, and I mean, clearly we're going to start getting fruit thrown at us figuratively from listeners. And I just want everybody to know that I didn't really mean to start it, but long as David's jumping, I mean, I don't want to lose face. I'm going to come up with better jokes.
Oh, you mean like this?
That's it. That's what we need.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent. So, Rob, does that mean you're going to be upping your game or lowering your game?
Good point. Only time will tell.
All right.
We have an Israeli news desk from Eyal, and he sends in the following. He says a tragic accident occurred. This was on February 26, when an LSA Sierra P2002 with two persons aboard crashed in the mountains near Jerusalem. Crash area is located about 5 miles from his home. And the weather condition, as he says, as I saw it at the time of the accident, was overcast with a very low ceiling. Mountaintops in that region are at about 2,700 feet, and the last radio report from the plane was received 2 minutes before the crash at an altitude of 2,500 feet. He said that LSA was certified for VFR, and the flight route from the takeoff airfield near sea level crosses the mountains to a destination at, now get this, the lowest airstrip in the world at Masada. At minus 1,200 feet? Wow, I didn't know that there was any place in the world, let alone an airfield, that was 1,200 feet below sea level.
Masada, is that mature?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
The pilot was 61 years old. Passenger was 31. They were found dead at the scene. This was a totally redundant flight at an inadequate weather with an unequipped airplane. And sadly, as Max Trescott just said recently, he says, pilots do not reveal new ways to kill themselves.
And I was just talking with the Vision Jet pilot as we were coming back a couple of hours ago about the Pilatus crash that Rob and I talked about in episode 221. Hmm. And just talked about how it's just utterly tragic that people don't seem to realize the stakes at hand. You know, either you fly well and you do it consistently, or you do it at your own risk and peril. And, you know, I think what he's suggesting here is that they flew in weather that was, you know, marginal at best. And unfortunately, they paid the price.
Yeah. Yeah. Very sad. For some better news from Elbit Systems again, the company will introduce at the Singapore Air Show 2022 a new version of the Skylark 3, a short range UAV. says the drone is equipped with a hybrid propulsion system. The original electric engine at the tail is joined with a combustion engine at the nose section. The electric motor will be used during cruise and will increase total endurance to almost 6 hours with reduced noise signature over the target area. Skylark 3 has a 14-foot wingspan, 90 pounds takeoff weight, service ceiling 15,000 feet, range 60 nautical miles. The Skylark family of drones has been ordered by 27 countries, and the new generation also includes the option that two Skylark 3 hybrid can be assigned to the same mission simultaneously managed by a shared ground control station. So thanks to Eyal for that report.
90 pounds, that doesn't sound like very much. Is that the total weight of the system or the total weight that it can carry? I mean, that would be a really small device. And it says it's got a wingspan of 15 feet. Ah, and you know what? Wikipedia says takeoff weight of 45 kilograms, so that's actually heavier. Oh, wait, no, that is about 90 pounds.
That is about 90 pounds. Yeah, so total weight.
Sure enough.
Yeah, lightweight guy. All right, results from our listener poll from episode 690. This is where we asked, should the U.S. federal government create a national no-fly list for unruly passengers? So the initial responses were all yes. But right now, it stands at 70% yes, 30% no. However, I will mention that the no statistic is a little bit overinflated because while we don't see email addresses or IP addresses or anything else when you answer one of our polls, we do see the timestamp, so we know when it was voted. And there's a series of like four or five no's that are like within seconds of each other. So I suspect that someone was either trying to vote multiple times or in error thought it didn't go through and kept trying and trying and trying and each time there was a vote. So in the future for these polls, just vote once, please. Just vote once.
Obviously, we're going to need legislation soon to look at new ways to control the vote.
Yeah, control.
I was just going to point out that there's a famous city where they talk about vote early and vote often, and I don't want to mention Chicago, but there's an obvious suspect here in our group.
That's a good point. And you know, the other thing we're famous for is that when bribes did happen in government, they were always in a brown paper bag. And the number of times I've said things to people like, hey, you know, if you've got some 20s, just put them in a brown paper bag. And everybody knows what I'm talking about. That is really scary.
That is sad. On to some listener mail. We got a great note from John, who has been listening for a couple of years now. While driving back and forth, he said it made his pandemic commute fly by even quicker. He looks forward to it every week. He says his first flight was on a TWA 707 in 1963. And he says, and I grew up as a Navy brat and have fond memories of A4D Skyhawks, F8U Crusaders, F4U Phantoms, and RA5 Vigilantes screaming, and they did scream, over our home outside Oceana NAS, Naval Air Station. But he attached an obituary from the London Times. It was from August 2021, but he said he recently ran across it while he was doing some other research. And this is an obituary for Yvonne Pope Sintas, who is listed as a pioneering aviator whose childhood obsession culminated in her becoming the first woman in Britain to captain a commercial jet. The article is pretty interesting in terms of somebody from that era, a woman from that era, who had an interest in aviation and flying, actually eventually making it. She apparently loved to watch airplanes when she was 8 years old. This was in 1939. She used to look up in the sky and watch airplanes. And she always wanted to fly. And she applied to the airlines. They turned her down. She applied to the RAF, turned down because she was a woman, and women didn't fly back then. So she started out on a kind of a path by becoming an air stewardess. Then she became a flight instructor. Then she was an air traffic controller. In 1965, she became a second officer and so forth. So the article talks about the difficulty of a woman pilot being accepted in commercial aviation back in those times. But John is reading a book. Apparently, she had written a book called Trailblazer in Flight, and he says he's really enjoying that. So that might be something to look into. And she died of pneumonia last year, August 2021, at age 90. So thanks, John, for putting that in. We'll have a link in the show notes where you can learn more, or you can look for that book, Trailblazer in Flight. Tom sent us an article. This is from boldmethod.com. I'm not sure what that is. 18 things you never knew about the B-52 Stratofortress. So it's an interesting list of various facts and interesting information about the B-52. So we'll have a link to that. As I told him, I said, probably David knows all these things. But
that's my thought, too. It's like the title is wrong. It's maybe one or two that David didn't know. It's not 18, that's for sure.
Yeah. A couple of ones that sort of surprised me is that in the ejection seats, so the crew are on two levels. And so the upper level pilots eject up the way most everybody ejects from an airplane. But this lower compartment, David ejects
ejected
downward.
Down.
Yeah, which when you think about it, it's like, well, it kind of has to, doesn't it? But I never knew about that.
Just don't want to be too close to the ground.
Yeah.
If you want to watch a really good view of the B-52, you need to watch Dr. Strangelove.
Well, yeah.
Even though that is a comedy.
Satire, yes.
It is really well detailed on what that B-52's cockpit looked like, as well as the weapon stations, the radio operator, the tail gunner, and the weapons master in the lower cabin of the B-52. It's a deep, dark hole. It's not the only aircraft that's ejected down. Believe it or not, the F-104 Starfighter originally ejected down.
Really?
That was one of the reasons why there was a lot of fatalities. It wasn't a really safe practice. I humbly have to admit that these were reminders of things, not necessarily. Most of them are pretty standard fodder for when you're talking about the big, ugly, fat fella.
You're talking about the tail gunner. One of these is that in 1972, the B-52 tail gunner Albert Moore shot down a MiG-21 over Vietnam. That was the last recorded bomber gunner to shoot down an enemy aircraft.
The tail gunner.
Tail gunner. One of the things that got me is, according to this, currently B-52s cost $70,000 per flight hour to operate.
I bet that doesn't include all the maintenance. That's probably just the direct, cost, fuel and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Eight engines.
Well, yeah.
Well, I mean, and the eight engines are going to be replaced. If anything, you have to admit that for an airplane this old, we're getting our money's worth out of this product.
Oh, God, yes.
After watching last week, after watching the Boeing documentary, it's sort of like, yeah, this is hard to believe that this is made by the same aircraft that just produced a 737 MAX. Like Max Flight said last week, if you haven't seen the Netflix documentary, you definitely need to watch it. And I really enjoyed watching it with someone who doesn't know all the details about the 737 MAX and the accidents and their reactions to the movie and some of the revelations and the scratching their head going, that doesn't make any sense. And
same thing on this side. My wife was scratching her head too, saying, how did they let this happen?
Yeah.
But I also did have to own up that, when the first crash occurred, and our friend of our show, John Ostrower, admitted this in the documentary, and I told Amber exactly the same thing. I felt the same way that it's just Lion Air. They screwed up. Their pilots are awful. In hindsight, but given their reputation, it was sort of like, yeah, I was like, yeah, no, I was on that boat. That was one of my first reactions. So it makes it feel even worse when you find out that Boeing actually was leveraging that in the documentary. It's like, but it was not surprising that we all had that reaction, you know, because it was a low-cost carrier and with a bad reputation.
All right, one last piece of listener mail that we want to get to from Patrick Wiggins. You may have seen that two Black Hawk helicopters crashed in Utah at a ski resort, I guess, because there's skiers all over and there's lots of videos of that. But the video that's in this article from KUTV is one that I hadn't seen. What you see is these helicopters going down to a low altitude, and then the snow is kicked up by the downwash, the powdery snow, which envelops the two helicopters, and something hits something in that snow cloud, which, whether it was a helicopter hitting the other helicopter or hitting a tree or something that then, sent the liberated rotor blade into the other one. I don't know. But David, when I saw that, I said, that doesn't seem like good practice to fly a helicopter down and create a snow cloud that envelops you and the other helicopter with you.
Well, in all fairness, they were training to operate in that environment. Talking to the people at the museum, I believe the second helicopter, and this would go also for landing in a desert environment where you're kicking up any sort of material and causing a white out or a brown out. Before you go in for your approach, you want the dust to settle, or in this case, the snow to settle. And it looks like what possibly happened was the second helicopter flew into the first, not seeing the other helicopter because of the snow downwash. What is kind of amazing was, even though there were some hurts, there was no fatalities, and not even anybody on the slopes occurred. But to do mountainous rescues and such, like the Alaska Air National Guard, Army National Guard does, and Utah's National Guard, H-60s can get skis and are designed to operate in hot climates and snow-filled climates. They were just doing routine practicing dealing with this. It's just unfortunate that they made a mistake in training, and it was costly.
Yeah, it's kind of a miracle that no one was injured.
Yeah, it's stunning. And I look at it, and you kind of wonder, why would they get that close to the ground when there's clearly, it's not a landing area? And once that cloud started going, it was just huge. I mean, the lateral dimensions of it look like they're probably more than 1,000 feet enveloping these two helicopters. And then as they go down and you lose sight of one, you think, wow, why didn't someone just say abort at this point? And why not discontinue the mission?
Or have your first helicopter land, let everything settle, and then, the second helicopter, I believe, should have gone around.
Yes. Right?
I think basically the first helicopter probably would have landed safely if the second helicopter had gone around. But basically they came in too close, too hot, and couldn't see each other. So,
yep.
But I wonder if they really intended to land, because it looked to me like basically a ski slope. If you put a helicopter down on the snow, unless it's compacted, they're going to be sinking down in it. But anyway, lots of questions, but a fast.
You can hover. You can have skis. Well, I'm sure they had skis. If they are training to deploy troops in that environment, you can land, or basically not fully land, but basically hover just above the ground effect so that people can get out or get aboard in that environment and then take off. So, but clearly it was a powder snow so that, it just all blew up.
All right. We're going to wrap this one up. I want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank George by aerospace.com for joining us in talking about electric airplanes. We'll have links to that website and all the news stories. Everything we talk about will be in the show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. You can go straight to that by visiting airplanegeeks.com/693. That'll take you right to the show notes. Don't forget this episode's listener poll. Again, that's airplanegeeks.com/poll693. Our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, David Vanderhoof, anything closing you'd like to say?
I'm looking forward to March 5th, where the exhibit is up and running and I can go back to normal life. I'd like to thank all of our listeners, the ones who've actually signed up to join the museum. And if it wasn't for this show, I would not get to do what I do now. And I'm more than appreciative to everybody. You know, Friday will be the dream of my life to be able to design and fulfill an exhibit at an aviation museum, no less. And part of that success has come from being on this show and my listeners and my co-hosts. So thanks to all of you who I see every week and to all of you who listen to us every week.
And congratulations, even though it's not Friday yet, on the exhibit, David. That's really impressive.
So do you think Kamala Harris... Oh, I'm sorry.
Kamala Harris. You think she's going to sign up?
Maybe she's going to just pop in unexpectedly.
Oh,
God, I hope not. I would not want the Secret Service and all of those guys to show up and ruin my opening.
Okay. Max Trescott.
We'll call him off.
Anything from you?
Sure. I've got to say that I really enjoy listening to David describing his exhibit and, you know, all the many facts and just fascinating history. So congratulations to you, good friend. You've done great work. And wish I were on the other coast and could get over there too to see it. But it sounds like a fabulous exhibit. So great job. And then the usual, yep, you can find us at aviationnewstalk.com. Thanks.
All right, Rob, anything from you?
Nice going, David. It was the pitch worked on me because I signed up. No pressure, but cool hat would be nice, but hey, no, you know, it's not a gotta have. I mean, it's just a, it would be cool if I had it. So, but no, hey, go for it, man.
You know, Rob, I can send you the link to the web store and you can purchase it.
What size head do you have, Rob?
Obviously
swollen.
All right. Way to go.
Touche, Mr. Flight.
Awesome. Anything from you, Rob?
No, they could find me in the usual places here, of course, and where I'm going to have to step up the competition, but also at jetwine.com and in the business and commercial aviation pages on the AFWeek site.
Very good. You can find me at 30,000feet.com, all words. And please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue sign up.
And thanks for listening.